Welcome to the Think Orange podcast, where we want to encourage and equip leaders like you who are investing in the faith and future of the next generation. I'm your host, Candace Nguyen, and for the next few weeks, we're getting to know some of the voices you'll hear at the Orange Conference 2023. This year, our workshops are led by some amazing thinkers like Will Hutcherson and Dr. Chinwe Williams. Will is a national speaker, the founder of Curate Hope, and a next-gen youth pastor of 15 years. Over the past several years, he has become increasingly passionate about finding practical ways to bring hope to kids and teens who are facing increasing amounts of anxiety, depression, and despair. Dr. Chinwe is a licensed and board-certified therapist and owner of Meaningful Solutions Counseling and Consulting. She is also a regular expert consultant at conferences, on podcasts, and especially here in the Orange World. Together, Will and Chinwe wrote the book Seen to help parents and leaders help teenagers in despair, and recently, they have launched the new course, Parenting with Mental Health in Mind. This course helps every parent learn the psychology of what's going on in their kid's brain and science-based practical tools to help every kid navigate a mental health crisis. You can buy a group license for the parents in your church by heading to store.thinkorange.com or check out the show notes for this episode to get a link. For now, enjoy this excerpt with Will Hutcherson and Dr. Chinwe Williams.
Hey everyone, welcome back to our mental health course, A Parent's Guide for Every Kid. In these courses and in our book, you'll hear us talk a lot about hope, and we want it to be loud and clear. There is always hope. Hope is one of those words that we hear so much, and it can mean so many different things. But let's talk about what hope means for our kids, for our teens, and young adults who are facing despair, depression, or anxiety. Hope not only helps us to look positively into the future, but it can also serve as a major protective factor that helps us push back against intrusive thoughts or even potentially dangerous ideation. One of my favorite quotes about hope is by Brené Brown. She says, "Hope is a function of struggle. People with the highest hopefulness have the knowledge that they can move through adversity. And when we take adversity away from our children, we diminish their capacity for hope." Think about that. As parents, part of our nature is to want to rescue our kids, right? I mean, when they were 9 months old and got stuck trying to crawl across the living room, we could just pick them up and lift them out of their struggle. And part of us still wants to do that with them now as older kids or teenagers, right? But we can't. If we just swoop in and rescue them with every obstacle and struggle, we rob them of the chance to learn how to deal with those situations. And instead of developing the tools that they need to navigate and manage adversity, our kids merely reinforce a dependence on us. And let me be clear, hope is not just passively wishing for something. Hope is a teachable set of skills and is seen as a powerful resilience tool. It requires active participation. It isn't denial, and it doesn't ignore reality. Instead, it is an actual belief that things will get better, and it creates a way to manage anxiety and stress. Belief and expectation are the ingredients of hope. Confidence, courage, and happiness are byproducts of hope. So how can we help build hope in our kids? Well, we're going to look at a few tools that we can use to help our kids build their own hope response. Aside from all the tools that we've already discussed in this course that creates feelings of feeling seen, safe, and understood, which will continue to build hope as well, there are three other elements that contribute to building hope. They are setting goals and working towards them, practicing gratitude, and number three, cultivating faith. Doing these things can help cultivate a positive expectation. Over time, our kids experience the positive feelings of accomplishment, and it shapes a belief and expectation that positive results can happen again, even in the face of resistance. Additionally, gratitude helps reframe our perspective. Gratitude studies show that those who practice gratitude on a regular basis improve their self-esteem, overcome hardship easier, and reduce stress. Let's start with goal setting, though. Dr. Chinwe has already touched on this in video 8 in reference to building grit. In the same vein, we want to mention it in terms of cultivating hope. there has been a tremendous amount of research and books and motivational presentations on the topic of goal setting. And this is a common topic in business and productivity circles. But we want to kind of simplify this and put it in the context of helping young people set goals. And we're going to keep it really, really simple. We want to create short-lived goals. Smaller goals that can be accomplished sooner are better than long ones. The idea here is to increase the frequency of the feelings associated with accomplishing a goal. Second, make goals fun. Goals don't have to be a big drag, even hard ones. Finding ways to make them moderately enjoyable will increase the desire for accomplishing a goal. For instance, I know one parent who asked their preteen kids to help them pack their room for a family move. The fun incentive? For every box that they filled of their things, they got to paint the outside of it and decorate it. A little weird, but it worked. Finally, write them down. Having goals written down increases the likelihood of those goals being accomplished. Now let's talk about gratitude. Here's another one of my favorite Brené Brown quotes. What separates privilege from entitlement is gratitude. Gratitude can be a reframing tool that serves as a powerful hope builder. One way to exercise the gratitude muscle is with the thankfulness journal. The simple act of writing some things down that we're thankful for can have benefits like better sleep, fewer symptoms of illness, and even more happiness. But instead of just handing your teen a blank journal and telling them to write down what they're thankful for, let's share a few quick tips to help them with this tool. Number one, don't overdo it. Once or twice a week is often more effective than every day. Now, this may seem counterintuitive, but studies actually show that those who've journaled once a week reported having a higher boost of happiness than those doing it more than 3 times a week. Number two, go deeper, not wider. Details about a few things for which they're thankful for are more beneficial than surface level things that they just list out. Number three, the power of people. It is often more effective to focus on the people that we're grateful for rather than the things that we're grateful for. Number four, surprises matter. Events that were often surprises create a bigger gratitude reaction. And number five, see gratitude as a gift. One expert suggests that when we make the conscious effort to see the things on our list as gifts, hope rises, gratitude rises. The last hope builder is faith. Studies show that faith plays a key role in developing hope and strengthening resilience. Now, even if faith hasn't been a part of your background, you can still benefit from the other two hope builders. But studies show that faith plays a significant role in building hope, and we don't want to pass this by. Personally, faith has played a powerful role in building hope in my life. The idea that there is always hope means that even in the gravest of circumstances, there is a hope for a better tomorrow. Faith in God gives us hope that the challenges of this life, yes, are there, but there is a hope that moves beyond our current circumstances and even beyond our last breath. In fact, Paul, the writer of Romans, believed this to be true even 2,000 years ago. His hope for people was this. He said, "May the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace as you trust in him, so that you may overflow with hope by the power of the Holy Spirit." Think about it. This recognizes that God is the God of hope. It goes on to remind us that hope is accompanied by joy and peace, and concludes by reminding us that God wants us to have so much hope in our lives that it's absolutely overwhelming. You see, hope isn't just well-wishing. Hope is powerful. It's a powerful mental health tool, and it can be a powerful tool as you help your kids in their mental health. And I'll leave you with this. Dr. Valerie Mahomes spent over a decade studying children in poverty and families in poverty at Yale University. She found that poor children who succeed have one common factor. Can you guess it? You're right. It's hope. She said, "Not talking about miracles. I'm talking about the hope and planning and motivation and determination." And isn't that what we all want for our kids? I think so. I'm so glad that we got to talk about what hope means in light of mental health. Go check out the workbook for some reflective questions and continue the conversation.
Hi, friends. I'm a licensed professional counselor, Dr. Chinwe Williams, and I'm one of your guides for this course, Mental Health, A Parent's Guide for Every Kid. Welcome back. In our last video, we talked about how parents and other caring adults in a kid's life are the best resource they have when it comes to their mental health, and how we have to take care of ourselves if we're going to take care of anyone else. I think we all know that it's impossible to pour from an empty cup. So now in this video, we're going to dive a little bit deeper. In order to understand exactly what's going on in your particular kid's mind, you've got to understand how the brain works. And yes, I know, you've probably heard all of this before and are having some major high school flashbacks right now, but I promise you it serves a purpose to have a general understanding of how things work up here. Why? Well, knowing how the brain works not only helps us to understand what's going on physically inside of us, it helps us to debunk some myths and unlearn a lot of misinformation we've internalized through the years. So the more we know, the more we see the value in getting our kids the help that they need. So before we get into the science, it's important that you really and truly grasp that mental health conditions are not a form of personal weakness. They're not a character flaw in you or your kid. There are so many other things that come into play. So let's break it all down, all right? So the two parts of the brain that are most involved in mental health are the frontal lobe and the amygdala. So the frontal lobe helps us to regulate those really big emotions and impulses. It's that part of the brain that helps us to use reason and logic. So now to the amygdala. Well, the amygdala is, let's just say, it's ground zero for some pretty big emotions such as fear, love, and even trauma. It's the amygdala's entire job to detect danger and activate our response to the threat. So think about the fight or flight response that I'm sure so many of you have heard. So the amygdala, perhaps more than any other part of the brain, plays a major role in anxiety, in despair, and so many more mental health conditions. So a lot of scientists believe that mental health conditions are caused by a breakdown in communication between neurotransmitters in the brain. So basically, something's not in sync. So let me give you an example. Clinical depression. That happens when there's not enough serotonin in the brain. So that's why a lot of medicinal treatments for depression use selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or commonly known as SSRIs. So SSRIs work to increase the amount of serotonin in our brain's neurons. And while some of this science is still unclear, scientists and brain researchers have identified three factors that increase someone's risk for a mental health condition. So those factors are genetic, environmental, and social. Let's begin with genetics. Some mental health challenges our kids face today have a strong link to genetics, including ADHD, bipolar, and depression. So for example, let's say you or one of your parents suffers from depression. There's probably a high likelihood that your child is going to suffer from depression too. However, we can't leave it all up to genetics. For a serious mental health issue to surface, it's going to require much more. It requires an interaction with several genes along with social and environmental factors. So that leads me to the next two factors that affect one's mental health: social and environmental. So obviously we are social beings, and that means that any situation that disrupts our sense of safety in our relationships or in our environment can actually have a really serious impact on us and especially on our kids. So that's why we see a lot of mental health conditions develop in kids who've been exposed to violence or who've experienced an interpersonal trauma, or who witnessed a significant amount of parental discord, or who've had a parent who has a severe mental illness, or if they've experienced abuse or neglect themselves, or a long period of poverty or economic hardship. Now, parents, each of these factors does influence the likelihood that your child may develop a mental health condition, but it's really about the combination of all of these factors in terms of determining whether or not the symptoms are mild, moderate, or severe. So now you're probably wondering, Dr. Chinwe, how do I even know if my kid has a mental health condition, especially when they seem to be really angry or irritable or moody? So That's true. Kids and teenagers, obviously, can be pretty moody and temperamental. And a lot of times, that's just where they are developmentally. That's why when you're looking for signs, you want to look for ones that are unusual in your particular kid. So it's like when your child gets a fever. You may say, wait, something's different with my kid. He seems a little bit off. I know with my child, Noah, when he's not feeling well, he talks way less, he's kind of a big talker, and he puts up less of a fight during bedtime. So I want you to be a detective. So put that detective hat on and get curious about what your kid is experiencing, or look for signs that they may be struggling. So here's some typical signs to look for. If they're feeling persistently sad, especially if that sadness is lasting 2 weeks or longer. If they're worried all the time and that worry just doesn't go away even after you reassure him or her. When there seems to be a lot of guilty feelings, or when they're withdrawing from friends especially, or when you've noticed a change in their academic performance, they don't want to go to school, so they're avoiding school altogether, and you're also noticing drastic differences in their mood, their behavior, or their personality. Another really significant symptom to look out for, especially with kids and teens, if they start to complain about having headaches or stomach aches, especially for the little ones, and it just doesn't seem to have any particular origin, or they're having trouble concentrating. Now, when it comes to self-harm or talking about death or suicide, that's when we really, really want to lean in, because those are very serious symptoms. So parents, sometimes even after noticing the signs, you're just not sure, and that's okay. That's when you consult a mental health provider or a pediatrician who can do an evaluation and determine what's next in terms of a treatment plan. Now, let's pause here and address something. I know even thinking about your kid's mental health is hard, let alone making a tough decision to put them on a psychiatric medication. I get it. It's really scary. It's a weighty decision. And as a mom, I definitely understand, and that feeling is normal. However, studies show that parents who are hesitant, for whatever reason, about using medication to treat their child's mental health condition are often basing that idea off of negative stigma about mental health that still, let's face it, exists. So for a lot of mental health professionals, medication is often a last resort. For me, it absolutely is. So we want to treat the reason for the symptoms before prescribing medications that may dull or alleviate the symptoms altogether. But parents, when your kid's anxiety or depression starts affecting their day-to-day lives, medication may be recommended. And if your kid struggles with thoughts of hurting themselves or others, the medication is definitely recommended. And parents, if your kid is already prescribed medication, it's still important to monitor their behavior in case there's a change needed in their dose. Just a heads up, it takes 4 to 6 weeks of your kid being on the medication to start feeling better, specifically for antidepressants. But let's be clear, medication doesn't cure anxiety, depression, or despair. However, it can help your child to manage his or her symptoms enough to be able to do things like participate in therapy, where they can learn more healthier ways to cope. So choosing whether to medicate or not medicate your kid is not an easy decision to make. But it is my hope that after viewing this section of the course, you're going to feel like you're in a better position to make the best, most informed decision for your child's mental health. Take some time to reference the workbook for more on this topic, and join us next time as we talk about the importance of inviting other people into this journey with you.
We want to thank you for joining us as we get to know the voices of Orange Conference 23. Now, if you like this episode, we'd also love for you to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. And don't forget to check out all the workshops and get your tickets to Orange Conference 23 at theorangeconference.com. We'll see you next time on the Think Orange podcast.